from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dr. Ben Carson is a very successful man. Grew up poor, black, rough, got to Yale, now a renowned pediatric neurosurgeon at the renowned Johns Hopkins, a best-selling author, motivational speaker, and philanthropist. He is a conservative man, deeply religious, given to saying that the best ideas come from God, not government. His words are music to the ears of conservatives still reeling from the nation's re-election of President Obama. The Wall Street Journal says it loud, Ben Carson for president. This hour On Point, Dr. Ben Carson and the national stage. You can join the conversation. Have you heard his speech at the National Prayer Breakfast this month? Was he right to go political in that setting? What do you hear in the worldview of Ben Carson? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will remember C. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General and an American original, who has died at 96. But first, let's roll the tape back to that moment, that morning, I guess, February 7th, National Prayer Breakfast. The president spoke. Here's President Obama.
It says something about us that every year in times of triumph and in tragedy, in calm and in crisis, we come together, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as brothers and sisters and as children of God. Every year, in the midst of all our busy and noisy lives, we set aside one morning together as one community, united in prayer.
And here was Dr. Ben Carson during his speech minutes earlier, sounding a little less kumbaya, a little more political on the question of taxing the rich, and his preference, the flat tax.
Now, some people say, well, that's not fair, because it doesn't hurt the guy who made $10 billion as much as the guy who made $10. Where does it say you have to hurt the guy? He just put $1 billion in the pot. You know, we don't need to hurt him. You know, it's that kind of thinking. It's that kind of thinking that has resulted in 602 banks in the Cayman Islands.
From the National Prayer Breakfast on February 7th in Washington, joining me now from Baltimore is Dr. Ben Carson, director of the Division of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, co-author of a series of books, including America the Beautiful, Rediscovering What Made This Nation Great, and Gifted Hands, The Ben Carson Story. His speech, one seat down from the president at the prayer breakfast this month, has gotten a lot of attention. You can see his remarks through our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Carson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
What were you thinking as you stepped to the podium at the prayer breakfast this year? What was your agenda, Dr. Carson?
I don't know if I would call it an agenda, but my purpose was to call attention to the spiritual state of our nation and to address some of the spiritual and moral issues that are affecting us in a great way.
How do you see those?
Well, I see, for instance, many of our founders, including Thomas Jefferson, said it is a moral failure to pass on debt to the next generation. Seems like we've forgotten about that. One of the pillars of our societal formation was freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And yet the political correctness police have imposed so many restrictions on people that people are afraid to express themselves. That doesn't sound like the right kind of moral or spiritual atmosphere to me. A situation where we have a nation supposedly of equal people in which we try to demonize one group or the other, divide people on lots of different issues, doesn't seem like something that leads to strength. In fact, a very wise man by the name of Jesus once said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. The fact that we now are usurping personal responsibility and placing that in the hands of the government, that we turn a blind eye to corruption, that we condone ignorance. These are some of the things that I wanted to address, but I also want it to be encouraging unity and vision and hope and reminding people of the very rich heritage of our nation. What I would like to do is get people to start talking to each other, to put ideals on the table, not to say that, oh, we can't talk about your ideal. Nope, that's politically incorrect. But let's all put our ideals on the table, and a multitude of counselors is safety. And this ideal of people putting themselves in one corner or the other and shooting at the other side, and the whole concept of this side winning and that side losing, to me, if one side wins and one side loses, then we've all lost.
Are both sides engaged in PC, political correctness policing, as you say, or are you seeing that on one side?
Well, you know, I will tell you that I am unaffiliated politically with Republicans or Democrats. I'm an independent.
Boy, are they eager to affiliate with you, sir.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, this is a societal problem that we have bought into, and it really is quite silly for a nation that has a major foundational pillar as freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
Absolutely. What's getting muted in your view, Dr. Carson? What kind of views are being muted these days?
I was talking to someone just this morning, and he said he'd been out of the country for a while. And he came back in, and they were in a room, and he was talking. And there was an Asian individual, and he referred to them as Oriental. He didn't realize that things had changed and that you couldn't use that term for a person anymore. And he was ostracized and criticized and made to be, you know, just the most horrible and insensitive person. You know, this kind of thing is just absolutely absurd.
You're African American. Are there words that might describe African American out of our history that you would take offense at these days?
Let me tell you a secret. I was doing an NPR interview a few years ago, and the correspondent said, "Dr. Carson, I notice you don't seem to mention race very often. Why is that?" And I said, "It's because I'm a neurosurgeon." And she was kind of put off. You know, I mean, what does that have to do with it? And I said, you see, when I take somebody to the operating room and I cut the scalp and peel it back and take off the bone flap and open the dura, I'm actually operating on the thing that makes that person who they are. The cover doesn't make them who they are. And those of us who are extraordinarily superficial in our thinking, we spend way too much time thinking about the cover and way too little time thinking about the content.
Have you been surprised by the vigor with which, I mean, it's not as though this is your first time out in public. You're a motivational speaker. You've been out a lot, well-known from very early on, prominent from very early on in the medical community. But have you been surprised just in these last couple of 3 weeks by the vigor with which the conservative media, let's say, have thrown their arms around you, Dr. Carson?
Well, what has surprised me much more than that is the incredible outpouring from Americans of all stripes, from all over the nation, particularly elderly people, who said, "I had given up on our nation. I was just waiting to die. And now I feel reinvigorated." The very fact that people have been so beaten down that they've given up like that is very disturbing to me. And I feel that we need to push this thing. I don't think this is a liberal thing or a conservative thing. I think this is an American thing. And interestingly enough, you know, if I look at my own, you know, political journey, you know, I used to be a Democrat. And the same principles that I hold dear to my heart now were very solidly embraced by the Democratic Party at that time.
Are you blaming the state of the nation that you describe as difficult or really troubled? Are you blaming it on Barack Obama? You were speaking more or less in his face at the prayer breakfast.
I would say if the shoe fits, wear it. But I'm talking about a cultural change that is occurring that is allowing for political correctness to have such a big role in our society, that is pushing away from people the sense of personal responsibility, that is pushing onto our society a role of government which was never intended by the people who founded this nation. And I would say whoever is doing that, be they Democrat, Republican, or Independent, this is who I'm talking to.
You've said, people ask you now, will you run for president? You've said, well, you'll let God decide that. How will you know, sir?
I would say that I have no desire to run for president. I have no desire to get into that whole arena because I do not believe in political correctness. I certainly don't believe in getting into a cesspool full of special interest groups. I wouldn't do it. There's just no way in the world that I would do that. And that's why I say the only way something like that's going to happen is to take a force greater than myself. I have no intention of doing it.
So here we are. What about President Obama's reaction to your speech? Could you read it in his face?
Well, I wasn't looking at him. I've heard a lot of people describe his face shooting darts of anger. I didn't see that when I looked at the tape, quite frankly. He came over to me afterwards, said he appreciated me being there. He admired me and shook my hand, and I didn't see any animosity. So I did not detect in him a sense that he was offended, but it wouldn't surprise me if, in fact, he might have been a little bit offended.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the conservative man of the moment, Dr. Ben Carlson, neurosurgeon, who spoke out at this month's National Prayer Breakfast in Washington. Now the Wall Street Journal says Ben Carson for president. Dr. Ben Carson joins us from Baltimore today. Dr. Carson, lots of callers for you. Matthew in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Matthew, thanks for calling. You're on with Dr. Carson.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, personally, with all due respect to Dr. Carlson, I think his constant references to political correctness are just kind of a cop-out. I think that, you know, the rich are not free from criticism. If he's going to be quoting Jesus in favor of his own ideas, and it should be pointed out that Jesus said that it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter heaven. And if he's going to, you know, Jesus was a Middle Eastern socialist, so, I mean, you can't exactly, you know, use him as, you know, this constant conservative stronghold and always be referring to political correctness.
Matthew, I appreciate your call. Dr. Carson, what do you say?
I don't connect what he said in any way to anything that I've said, quite frankly. It sounds more like he's listening to somebody different. I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, the idea of the rich, along with everybody else, and even by your own, I guess, refutation of political correctness, being open to criticism.
I have no problem criticizing everybody. I don't see anything that I've said that takes sides with rich, poor, or middle. If you can point that out to me, I'd be very happy to comment on it.
You know, in the remarks we played at the opening here, you described progressive taxation as punishment for the rich. Why do you see it as punishment?
Let me explain that. If you have a proportional tax system, proportionality is the fairest system that you can possibly come up with.
By proportionality, do you mean flat tax by that? Is that what you mean when you say proportionality?
I mean that everybody pays according to their ability. That's what proportionality is. That's what tithing is. So if you make a very small amount of money, you make a very small contribution. If you make a very large amount of money, you make a very large contribution. Now, my point in saying what I said is that just because someone has made a lot of money and has made a large contribution, you don't then go and say, well, they need to make even a larger contribution. They've already given their proportional amount. But here's what's even more important about proportionality. If you have what is to be an equitable society where everyone is equal, then everybody needs to contribute to the maintenance of that society. There shouldn't be some people who are excluded and other people who are piled upon. And the reason that that's so important in the kind of governmental system that we have is if everybody is putting money into the pot proportionally, it forces the government to be much more fiscally responsible because every time you raise taxes, you're raising taxes on everybody, not just on 1% or 2% or 5% who you can marginalize because they don't have the ability to vote you out of office.
Do you think the rich
That's
are
one of the
piled
oldest
up
ploys
upon,
in the book.
Do you think the rich are piled up upon today and marginalized in our country's life and power?
I don't think so, no. But I don't
it
want
seemed
them
like
to
that's
be.
What you were suggesting there.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. Listen very carefully to what I said.
Yes, I do. I will.
I said in terms of proportionality, if a person makes $10 billion a year, mm-hmm. they pay. If you're doing it on a 10% basis, they pay $1 billion. If somebody makes $10 a year, they pay $1. Now, when you come back and say, yeah, but it didn't hurt the guy who put in $10 billion, who put in $1 billion, because he's still got, you know, $9 billion left. Why do you need to go back and hurt that guy?
I quite agree.
What about already put in $1 billion in the pot, which goes a long way for taking care of our problems.
Of course, hurting is just one way of looking at it. What about President Obama's argument that our country has enormous needs right now, we need to make investments in the future, the way income is distributed, the wealthy have a lot of the assets that might be helpful in doing that, and they can afford to chip in? You may or may not agree, but what about that perspective?
Again, the moment you move away from proportionality, then you become engaged in ideology. And that's why when fairness dictates doing things equally for everybody, the moment you move away from that, you get into ideology and you can have all kinds of arguments.
You're a smart guy. I mean, isn't it ideology either way? Isn't a flat tax an expression of a kind of ideology as well?
I think the flat tax proportionality is fair. Describe to me how proportionality is not fair.
I'm not here to carry the torch for it, but people might say, you know, if you've got those billions of dollars and you can afford to chip in when the country needs it, you know, a progressive tax can be understood as proportional. It really depends on your ideology in assessing it.
Proportionality, if God thought it was fair, I think it's fair too. It's onus on somebody else to prove to me why God is wrong in his assessment of what is fair. Also, bear in mind that our nation has a rich history of generosity. Back in the 1800s, you know, we were criticized severely because there were people like the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and Kellogg's, Ford, Carnegie Mellon. These people had a lot of money. Europeans looked at us and they said, you know, you can't run a governmental system like that with all these rich people and then everybody else being poor. That doesn't make any sense. You've got to have an overarching government that receives the funds and then can redistribute it in an equitable way. Well, what they didn't realize is that America was different. All of those people that I just mentioned, instead of just hoarding money and passing it down from generation mm-hmm. to generation, they built up the infrastructure of this nation, put in the transcontinental railroad, factories, textile mills, created the mechanism to create the most powerful and dynamic middle class the world has ever seen, built libraries and universities and charitable foundations.
Yeah.
In 2009, 40 of the wealthiest families in America pledged to give away half of their wealth to charity. Go to Europe and ask 40 wealthiest families to do that. They'll look at you like you got six heads. This is a different nation.
I think
and
you
we
are.
We have a rich heritage of giving, and we don't want to discourage that by creating class warfare.
I think you are or were on the board of directors of the Kellogg Company. How are they doing?
They're doing very well.
I want to play a little bit from the prayer breakfast when you were talking about health care and how to pay for it. And here, this was a couple of weeks ago at the prayer breakfast, promoting health savings accounts. Here you are, Dr. Carson, from that morning.
When a person is born, give them a birth certificate, an electronic medical record, and a health savings account, to which money can be contributed pre-tax from the time you're born to the time you die. When you die, you can pass it on to your family members so that when you're 85 years old and you got six diseases, you're not trying to spend up everything. You're happy to pass it on, and there's nobody talking about death panels.
Dr. Ben Carson at the National Prayer Breakfast on February 7th. We'll look at that. David in Beaver Dam, Kentucky. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Hi. Dr. Carson.
Hello.
I consider myself a conservative Christian, and I just want to say that it's so refreshing to hear someone just shoot it straight like you've been. and whether you decide to run for president or not. I just hope that you will just stay on the national stage in some way or form to continue the dialogue of just, you know, the conservative way of thinking, because I think our country has just got we're in a hole right now that we're trying to dig out of, and folks like you that are speaking the truth in plain English is very refreshing. And I just thank you, sir, and I'll say God bless, and I'll just hang up and let you respond. Thank you.
David, thank you for your call. Dr. Carson?
Well, thank you for that. You know, I've been just overwhelmed by the response of people, and it's because they just want to hear some common sense. You know, what I'm saying, I think, is not anything that's strange and weird. You know, for instance, on the other side, you have, you know, these PhD economists who say, you know, we got this big problem with deficits and debts, and all we need to do is spend more money, and the more money we spend, the more we generate positive influence. You know, come on, give me a break. You know, people are not that stupid. They really aren't. And they just need to hear some common sense.
Let me ask you in common sense terms, on the health savings account, how would that work? I mean, we know what healthcare costs are in this country. You say, you know, start a savings account the moment someone's born, but even if most people save for years and years, if they then ran into, you know, you name it, cancer or something significant, how would any individual's health savings cover the cost of that? Isn't that the common sense of having insurance so that we pool our resources and those who end up with bigger health needs have access to the resources to treat those?
Yes. However, 80% of the interactions that are going to occur with the medical profession and average person are not going to be those catastrophic events. And we need a way to be able to address those, and health savings accounts are perfect ways to do that.
So they're not meant to cover major medical expenses?
No.
But just,
of course not. You're going to have other mechanisms for taking care of catastrophic health care, and also the ability to buy bridge insurance for things in between. You know, all of that is explained in some of my other writings.
What do you think of the Obama health care reforms that will come into effect soon?
I believe everybody's going to see pretty soon what Nancy Pelosi was talking about when she said you got to pass it before you see what's in it. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be something that most people are going to enjoy.
Why?
Because, first of all, you know, half of the savings are a result of cutting Medicare. So that money has to come from someplace. And it's coming out of the hides of hospitals and healthcare providers who already are severely stretched. So now if you pile more things upon them, you can imagine what the effect of that is going to be. There was a survey, documented, last year looking at primary care providers and how happy they were with what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the results, as you probably know, pretty astonishing. They were not very happy, primarily because, not because, you know, they don't enjoy their profession, but because in order to make ends meet, they had to see so many patients, on average of a patient every 12 to 15 minutes. And they weren't able to really apply the wonderful things that they had learned. You know,
so you're saying when we cover tens of millions of more people, that's just
going to be that much worse.
But what's the – what should we leave them uncovered? What's the alternative?
No. You got about 6 hours?
No.
What we need to, first of all, recognize that we have to take this thing out of a conservative liberal battleground and start thinking about what works for everybody. Do we pay enough money to be able to provide good health care for everybody? Well, yes, we do. We pay on average $7,000+ per capita per year. The next closest nation is about half that. And yet, we have tremendous access problems. and tremendous inefficiency in our system. So we're putting, it's not that we don't care about people's health care. We put in enough money, twice as much as anybody else. So it's a matter of retooling. If you have an HSA and you take that same money that we're already using, but you contribute it to people's HSAs,
health savings
over which
account.
They now have control.
Mm-hmm.
When they get a problem with their ankle, they can go directly to the healthcare provider. There's no middleman involved. They can get the problem diagnosed, resolved. And also, because of that relationship that now is developed between those two without a third party being in between, you have much more fiduciary responsibility. That doctor
on the part of the individual, you're saying,
both.
And the doctor who's going to say, oh,
both.
This is right out of your account.
Exactly.
Dr. Carson, stand by for a second. Jonathan Cohn joins us for just a moment here, senior editor at The New Republic, author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He's been thinking about health care, the Obama plan, your observations. Jonathan Cohn in Ann Arbor, Michigan today. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be on the show.
What do you think of Dr. Carson's rather high-profile critique of Obamacare in recent weeks? Is he on to something here?
Well, let me say, you know, first of all, I have great respect for Dr. Carson's work, and as someone who lives in Michigan, his extremely inspiring story. I do think he's a little misguided about health policy. You know, there is this long-running debate about what, you know, conservatives like to call how much skin people should have in the game.
That is, citizens, when it comes to their health and how they treat themselves, maybe.
Basically, the idea is, you know, when you have insurance, right, insurance mm-hmm. is paying your bills. The theory is you're less likely to think about how well you spend your money because it's not your money.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you have to pay personally, the more that you pay out of pocket, the more responsible you're going to be. The more you'll think twice before, you know, getting an unnecessary procedure and such.
Yep.
The HSA health savings account scheme that Dr. Carson has in mind, this isn't one attempt to address this issue by having people pay more of their own money. Now, I actually think there's something to that, and I think most people who study healthcare would say, yes, that's true, and there's a way in moderation to do that. The problem is it's very easy to err on the other side, and we actually have a lot of data.
Meaning what, John?
Well, when you ask people, you know, you tell people you're going to pay more of your bills out of pocket, so you need to think more carefully about, you know, when you get healthcare. The problem is people don't always make really good decisions. In fact, they frequently make bad decisions.
So they may not get care when they need it and therefore get worse?
The classic example, and there's a lot of academic work to back this up, a lot of studies, is that, you know, we've got experience where we give people with high blood pressure higher copayments on their prescription drugs. Guess what they do? They don't take their high blood pressure medication. And then what happens? And then they get a heart attack, and then they show up at the hospital. We actually end up spending more to treat them. And by the way, they end up in worse health. And this has been replicated time and again in other studies. In addition to that, if you ask people to pay more, it's going to quickly overwhelm not just what the poor can pay, but even what the middle class can pay. So the trick here is finding some way to give people some individual responsibility, to give them a little skin in the game, but not too much so that they have they end up doing things that are bad for them
yep.
and bad for the system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the conservative man of the moment, Dr. Ben Carson, neurosurgeon who spoke out at this month's National Prayer Breakfast. Now the Wall Street Journal says, Ben Carson for president. In a moment, we'll look back on the life of C. Everett Koop, surgeon general in the 1980s, who has died at 96. Ben Carson joins us from Baltimore, up from pretty rough, poor childhood story that has inspired people, motivational speaker, philanthropist, big neurosurgeon, very prominent in that arena. Jonathan Cohn is with us for another moment here, too, from The New Republic, with us from Ann Arbor today. Dr. Carson, there's Jonathan Cohn saying, yes, let's look for ways to give people incentives to take care of themselves and not overspend, but be careful with health savings accounts. You know, it can tip right over into not taking care of oneself or into costs just outstripping what people can afford.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the work of Jonathan Cohn. I know he spent a lot of time working on healthcare, and I appreciate that. I would say probably we're not that far apart on many things, but one of the, probably the place where we diverge the most is I'm more of a personal responsibility type of guy and would be designing programs that allow people to use the monies that are already designated for them. This is what I'm talking about. Okay, so
that they have saved, you mean?
That has been put into their HSA.
By themselves?
Not necessarily by themselves, mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. That money is already in a gigantic bureaucratic pot. It can be redistributed very much in the same way that the food stamp program works. And, you know, a lot of people were against that in the beginning. But I'll tell you what, you give people food stamps and you think they're going to be irresponsible. They learn very quickly not to go out the first 5 days and buy porterhouse steak and then starve the rest of the month. People are a lot smarter than you think they are.
Jonathan,
and it's just a matter of being fair with them.
I've just got you for another minute, Jonathan. Where do you see Dr. Carson's view, his critique of Obama's health care reforms, sort of falling in the spectrum of health care professionals? Is he in the mainstream, one side or another? What do you see, John? What do you see there, Jonathan?
Well, you know, I think you find health professionals sort of all over the map on this. I mean, there are some who love the plan, Obama health care plan. There are some who hate it. You know, one thing I will mention, two things very quickly, because I know I need to go, but first is that, you know, I, with all due respect, I think the comparison to food's a little misleading. I mean, I can pretty easily figure out what food is good for me, but I'm extremely well educated, and I'm not, shouldn't be making diagnosis decisions. You know, there are some decisions I think consumers can make well, but at some point, medicine is just a lot more complicated. The other quick point is, I suspect, and I find this a lot, people don't realize, a lot of conservatives who make the argument similar to what Dr. Carson is making, that the actually Obama health care plan is more like their ideal than they realize. You know, the minimum plan that are people are required to get if they're buying insurance on their own, you know, through these new exchanges, the minimum plan that they have to get looks a lot like an HSA. It's got a pretty high amount of cost-sharing individual responsibility. So, you know, people are allowed to buy more comprehensive insurance, and the truth is most people like it. But they might be, you know, Dr. Carson might want to take a closer look at that. He might be surprised it's not as far away from his ideal as he thinks.
Jonathan Cohn of the New Republic, thank you so much for being with us today, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Dr. Carson, callers for you. Debbie in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on with Dr. Ben Carson.
Thank you. Listening to Dr. Carson earlier on your program has compelled me to call. Mm-hmm. When he was extolling the virtues of the robber barons for building the wonderful infrastructure that we have in this country, completely ignores the fact that that was done by exploiting thousands and thousands of people to do so. And to not mention that, as one mentions, all this great infrastructure seems to be a really big blind spot.
Those could be pretty rough days for labor. Dr. Carson, what do you say?
I think there is absolutely nothing that is ever done that is perfect, and it doesn't matter what you bring up, I can find something wrong with it.
That's
you need
a
to
pretty...
understand what the point is. You know, and here's, you know, when I started.
But does that mean that the exploitation of, I don't know, you name the group, let's say in the building of the railroads, it got pretty rough, a lot of people died. Is this.
Was that good? No. Was slavery good? No. All of those things were bad. And, you know, I can go through a whole list of bad things.
So can we do better today?
And we can concentrate on those. We can learn from those, and we can move on and do things better. But to just take the bad and say that that negates the good, I think, is a spurious argument.
Margaret in Buffalo, New York. Margaret, you're on the air with Dr. Carson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been listening for the past half hour, and I just want to make a comment about Dr. Carson saying that he's not speaking either from a liberal or conservative point of view, but sort of a common sense approach. I find that a bit hypocritical because everything he's saying sounds to me like it comes right from a conservative manual. And I find that sort of disingenuous to claim that this is not conservative philosophy. I what am I missing?
Dr. Carson?
I'd like to know what I've said that doesn't make sense.
No, she didn't say that. She simply said it sounds like it comes from a conservative playbook.
then basically what she's saying is that conservatives make sense. That's what she's saying. That's essentially what you just said.
Well, I didn't hear about sense, but she's going more to the point of your claim of being neither left nor right. And she said
I claim to be a common sense person. And the things that I'm talking about, I don't think they should be conservative or liberal. I think they should be things that benefit everybody. See, we're too interested in taking everything and categorizing it in one party or another party. And we're too interested in sniping at each other. And we're too interested in saying my point of view is the only right one, rather than sitting down and having intelligent, open discussions about the pros and cons of the way that we do things. Once we learn how to do that, then we're going to make real progress.
I think it's great when people speak up. I mean, that's what citizenship ought to be. Let me ask you, you're a physician. That means a man of science. You're also a religious man. I have read that you do not accept the theory of evolution. What do you think on that front?
Well, that's a very long conversation. But the fact of the matter is, I believe that God did in fact create us. I think he used very excellent scientific ways of doing it. I do believe in natural selection or microevolution, that things have the ability to adapt to their environment and to change. But I see that as a sign of an intelligent creator who didn't want to start over every 50 years. I have no evidence that one species can turn into another species. I'm open-minded, and when someone can show me where that has happened, I'd be very happy to accept it. I look at the complexity of our universe. We can predict 70 years hence when a comet is coming. Such precision. To say that there was a Big Bang and all of that just happened, that requires a great deal more faith than I have.
Are you saying with that you believe God made all the species from the get-go?
I believe that God created each species specifically.
So they didn't evolve one from the other or from some original. So that really is...
There's no evidence that one species turns into another species.
And what about...
That's conjecture.
I've just got another minute with you. Again, you're a man of faith. It's quite public. How do you see the dictate of Jesus to care for the poor? How far does that responsibility go as a Christian? How do you see that playing out in public policy?
I think we are our brother's keepers. I think we have great responsibility toward the poor. And I think one of the best things that we can do for the poor is to create mechanisms whereby they can empower themselves, not mechanisms that say, you poor little thing, you can't do anything for yourself, I'm going to take care of you, don't you worry about a thing. That's what I call a backhanded slap.
Are you going to stay in the public arena? You're retiring from surgery this summer.
I will continue to be in the public arena, absolutely. No question about it.
And what would it take to put you there in a political, explicitly political way?
That's going to take the guy who created the universe.
Dr. Ben Carson, Director of the Division of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, author of America the Beautiful and Gifted Hands, The Ben Carson Story. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, we remember C. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General of the United States. This is On Point. This is On Point. C. Everett Koop, maybe the most influential Surgeon General in American history, died last night at 96. Appointed by Ronald Reagan in 1981, he became a household name as he crusaded against smoking and explained the still new and terrifying scourge of HIV/AIDS. Joining me now from Ghent, New York, to talk about his legacy is Michael Spector, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Michael Spector, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tom.
Remind us of the circumstances of C. Everett Koop coming into that office and the figure he cut once he was there, maybe the figure he cut first.
Well, the figure he cut has something to do with the circumstances. He was the most polarizing public health official ever appointed to any body in the United States. He was a profoundly right-wing evangelical Christian who became famous for writing a book and then making a movie called Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which was a stridently anti-abortion document. He really jump-started the evangelical movement to oppose abortion. And he was also, it must be said, a brilliant surgeon who worked for many years at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, but had no public health experience. So when Ronald Reagan appointed him in 1981, it was seen, I think, correctly, as just a purely ideological selection. And it created an unprecedented political war over his confirmation, the type of war we seem to have every day now, but had never happened before.
He had strong support from conservatives, Jesse Helms, Strom Thurmond in those days, the most prominent farthest right conservatives.
He was the right wing's gift from God. They couldn't ask for someone more like them, more likely to do their bidding, and there was no reason to expect anything other than what he'd always delivered in terms of ideology.
So what unfolded in the course of his time as Surgeon General?
He turned out to be a man of astonishing, almost unprecedented principle. And his main principle was that scientists have to follow the dictates of science, which means looking at facts and evaluating situations based on facts. He never changed his religious positions. I saw him late in life. It isn't like he had a conversion, but he felt that when it came to scientific information, he was required to present to the American people the truth, which he saw as a compilation of data. And those truths were almost always shockingly different from the beliefs people thought he held.
Give us the big examples, Michael.
Well, the big examples are, the smoking thing is one would expect a Surgeon General to be opposed to smoking. However, Jesse Helms came from North Carolina, the big tobacco state. He was his biggest supporter. And Coop was extremely vigorous in opposing smoking, and the first Surgeon General who said secondhand smoke causes cancer and we should abolish this plague, I think he said by 2000, which alas has not happened. But the biggest thing was he became Surgeon General at the time exactly when the AIDS epidemic started to affect the United States. And that was a time of tremendous fear, of discrimination, and of hatred of homosexuals. And President Reagan asked him to do a report for the American people on AIDS, fully expecting this to be the type of report everyone else expected it to be, a kind of political statement of what you should and should not do.
In terms of sexuality, sexual behavior, homosexuality.
Sexual behavior, yes. Sexual behavior, basically, if you don't have sex, you're not going to transmit HIV unless you get it from needles. Mm-hmm. And those two things are things that were objectionable. And so if you stop that, problem goes away. The problem is that it isn't that simple, as we found out 30 million deaths later. Mm-hmm. And Coop saw that. He interviewed many people, and he stunned America by issuing a report that was, above all, absolutely honest. One in which he said, for instance, by the time children entered the third grade, they should be instructed on what condoms are and how to use them to protect themselves from transmitting sexual diseases.
He recommended this compulsory sex education in schools. That was a big statement then.
It was like the political equivalent of a nuclear bomb dropped. It was just inconceivable. But it wasn't inconceivable to people who believed in public health. It wasn't inconceivable to people who understood that viruses are not political, they're not religious, they have no sexual orientation. And Coop looked at the data, and he saw that very clearly. It's not something hard to see. And he acted not on his religious faith, but on his faith in science.
He never endorsed homosexuality, always described it, you say, Michael, as morally objectionable in his universe. But when it came to policy, it was science, I guess you're saying, that he followed.
Yeah, I mean, he was a man who didn't believe that homosexuality was acceptable under what his view of God's universe was. He wasn't, he was not, believe it or not, an offensive evangelical. He believed what he believed, but he didn't feel like he needed to shove it down everyone's throat. And that's what was surprising. So, yeah, he had these beliefs, and I believe them to be wrong. But he didn't let those religious beliefs dictate the way he acted as Surgeon General. More importantly, after this happened, Reagan decided that he ought to do a report on the psychological consequences of abortion. And that was something that the conservatives felt very strongly about. It was very clear to them that this was going to be a report that would signal the pain and the horrors of abortion and make it so clear that there were these searing decisions that shouldn't be made. Well, after all, Koop is a man who compared abortion to Nazi deaths in Auschwitz. They thought they had it wrapped up. He went out and interviewed hundreds of people, read hundreds of documents, met for many, many hours with many staff members. And one day, one man said, the Surgeon General is not going to issue an abortion report.
And the reason being?
Well, I was shocked. And I said, what's going on here? He said, well, he's looked at the data, and he can't really say, based on the data that exists, whether this is something that would be worse, that having an abortion is necessarily worse than not having an abortion. There may be psychological side effects to having a child that are more damaging to having an abortion. It depends on the circumstances.
A complex man, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. Michael Spector with New Yorker Magazine, thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.